Today on Speaking Out of Place, I talk with Leanne Bidasumuse-Simpson about her new book, Theory of Water. Theory of Water is a rich, complex, and deeply personal reflection on world-making and life-giving processes, best captured by the fluidity of water as it circulates through our bodies and the planet. It's a largely collective project that enlists our listening and love and helps us face the violence of all forms of dominance, enclosure, and containment. We're especially gifted to have the chance to listen to one of the songs from Leanne's album, Theory of Ice, and have her comment on it and the relation of her music to her writing. This is a particularly special episode of Speaking Out of Place. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback, suggest people to invite, and topics to cover. Also, please check out my book of the same title, published by Haymarket Books. Kianga Yamata-Taylor calls it, quote, the exact book we need for the troubled historical moment through which we are living. Leanne, thank you so much for being here. It's a wonderful pleasure and honor, and your book is so rich and complex and poetic at the same time. I told you we'd spend about an hour, but I could literally spend the whole evening talking about the subtleties and the nuances and the significance of this book. It's so evocative, and the title is also so counterintuitive to those of us in the West. You write about Nibi as, quote, as theory or a mapping of life and affiliation and global connection. In other words, as a form of indigenous internationalism, but also, and finally, as embodied process, end quote. So that's such a great constellation of ideas that I do think informs the heart of the book. So could we spend some time just asking you to unpack that leisurely in any way you want? We can get to any of them in greater depth at some point, but just to give us all an orientation to the book.
Sure. So I think that part of colonialism for Indigenous peoples has been this idea that Indigenous peoples aren't thinking peoples and that we don't have thought on a kind of systemic level. So I think one of the things that I was interested in doing is intervening in that, because I think Indigenous people have a lot of beautiful, very intellectual, theoretical contributions to make to the world. And a lot of our theory is encoded in story, but a lot of our theory is also encoded in land-based practice. So you can't learn about it from reading books or from going to lectures. You have to really be out on the land with elders doing over long periods of time. Another way I think that Indigenous peoples find meaning in life and find explanations for the world around them comes from observing and having a very close and intimate relationship with the natural world and learning from the natural world. And so I think in Canada, at least, for the last few decades, we've been very focused as Indigenous scholars and artists on land. And land is incredibly important. And I see that in my own work. Within Anishinaabe thought, of course, water is part of land. But I wanted to spend some time thinking alongside water to try to escape some of the containers that Western thought has put around land, some of the bordering, some of the fixedness. And that's when I started to listen to water, when I started to think alongside water, when I started to spend a lot of time with water, I also started to think a lot about solidarity, a lot about Indigenous internationalism, a lot about deep sort of connections outside of my own body and outside of my own sort of regional territory. And that to me was something that was very powerful. And it made me want to sink into this listening and this thinking alongside to an even greater depth, I think.
As I was reading it, you have this portion of the book about gifting. And I was thinking that way back, God, in the 80s, I was living in Kyoto and I was learning about Japanese culture, and they have this idea that you can give somebody a gift, but that person is not obliged to keep it. They can gift it to somebody else. And there are these wonderful stories of at one point you're at a party or an event and you get your own gift back to you. So the idea is this circulation, exactly, this non-fixity, but rather a gesture that's embodied. And the idea is not focusing on the possession, it's rather on the act and the connection between people. And the other term that I like a lot is the idea of sintering, which is, you beautifully put it in terms of these fractal formations in nature. And a lot of what your book does is it takes, as you say, the words, but it embodies them in phenomena and in practices. Can you tell us more about sintering? Because I think that's such an important element.
So, sintering is a term that I learned as a skier earlier on in my life. And it's a term that I think anyone who has experience with snow knows, because if you don't go out and shovel the white, fluffy snow that first falls, if you wait 24 or 48 hours, then you've got a bigger job on your hands because the snow has sintered, it's compacted, it's harder to shovel. But in this book, I talk about one of the pandemic winters deciding to volunteer to groom the local ski trail as a way of keeping up my snowmobile skills for when I'm not in the north. And so I would be going out in the mornings, I would be listening to podcasts, and I would be driving very slowly, because when you're grooming, you drive very slowly so that the machinery has a lot of contact with the snow and the weight has maximum compaction. So I'm doing this kind of repetitive thing every morning, listening to different podcasts, and I'm thinking about sintering as I'm helping the snow sinter. And I start to do a little bit more research into the science behind it. And I'm thinking about snowflakes and how they are continually undergoing these transformations, falling from the sky world into a grounded reality. And that the first thing they do when they fall into that grounded reality is find a way of physically bonding to their neighbors to create this snowpack, which has a longer, stronger staying power than individual snowflakes. And that to me became a very interesting metaphor for building kinds of networks and solidarity that I think we need in this moment, facing climate change, facing increasing fascism, all of the things that are going on in our world. And so it was interesting to me that I would learn this directly from spending a lot of time in the woods with snow. Where in the past I've learned a lot of this kind of knowledge from elders or from cultural sources, but this was one of the first times where I felt like the land was teaching me something direct. And I think that moment sent me on a deeper journey to think through the waters that I was in contact with on a daily basis and what those waters might be trying to teach me.
Yeah, it's so useful in so many ways. And especially one of the things I liked about the book is how it helps me with my activism, in the sense that, as you well know, activists tend to have lots of ego because we are committed, right? We feel we have to be useful and that we have a kind of mandate. But that can also make us very brittle and very unwilling to share space and to step back. And I think what sintering helped me understand is that it's not that I've become something else, I've just taken on another shape. And that's not a permanent re-identification. It's just at that moment, this is what's needed. And to be attuned to that and not be so graspy in some ways without thinking that letting go is a failure on your part. Do you ever get that sense when you're working
For
in
sure. And I
activism?
think what sintering does for me is it privileges and it centers the community and the structure and this larger thing that we're trying to build or we're trying to maintain. It takes the individual and that ego and those emotions out of it a little bit. And so I think that made it a very useful tool for me in daily life, in activist life.
Yeah, and it's not just relating to people differently, but one thing that helps me do that is to be more in nature and just be connecting with non-humans, essentially, and seeing that's a powerful, not an antidote, but a complement almost to the kinds of things that we can become a necessity very committed to, but that can also lead us astray. You had these great examples, and there's so many wonderful stories, but the story that I think gets to so much of what I'm deeply interested in is the story about eels. And you reference Alexis Pauline Gum's Undrowned many times, and I love that book. It's so amazing. And I got that flavor when you were talking about eels, because I think the story begins with, I wasn't used to seeing eels. So there's this marking, and you didn't even know if they were absent. You just think that they didn't belong there. But then you unpack this sort of long history. So I don't want to take the words out of your mouth. Could you please tell us that story?
So I chummed around with an elder, Doug Williams, who was from Curve Lake and has passed away. But we were great friends and we spent a lot of time in our territory over almost 3 decades. And so I learned a great deal from him. Him and I were out in the woods one day, and we were out on a particular creek that was flowing into Stony Lake, and he started talking about eels. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I was like, what do you, there's eels, there's sea lampreys in the Great Lakes, there's eels in the Sargasso Sea, but what are you talking about? He was talking about how they were a great protein source. He was talking about how they were incredibly abundant in the early 1800s. He was talking about how we had stories and songs and knowledge. And he talked about how when he was a kid, he remembers seeing there was a few landlocked eels that survived for a bit in those upper lakes. And so through talking to him, I understood this relative of mine that I had never known and that I didn't know about and that my generation had largely forgotten about. So I started thinking a little bit about shifting baseline syndrome, where you don't even know what you've lost in terms of the natural world. But then I started to trace or think about this body of knowledge that has been lost because we don't have these relatives visiting us anymore. And I'm interested, I love species that spend a little bit of time here, but not all their time here. So migratory birds, the eels, there used to be a resident population of salmon in Lake Ontario. So these eels are from the Sargasso Sea. I know nothing about the Sargasso Sea. I know nothing about salt water. They used to come through the St. Lawrence River, through Lake Ontario, and up into the lakes near where I live, and then go back. And so what kinds of knowledge were they transmitting? Like their bodies were transmitting information about the health of those bodies of water, the places that they were spending the other months of the year in. And it became, I think, a teacher to me of how, although often when we think of Indigenous knowledge, we think of it as being very intimate and regional and very detailed about place, which it is, it's also about connecting our ecosystems in our homelands to every other living thing on the planet across great distances on a kind of yearly seasonal cycle way. So I started through this kind of investigation, started to recognize the world as this deep networked space of interconnected living species expanding through time and space, and that I was a sort of node in the network, that humans were nodes in the network, and that the purpose of life, according to Anishinaabe thought, is to live in a way where you're bringing forth more life, where you're giving up what you can to make sure that the other living things that you're sharing time and space with on the planet are also able to live. And so that shift, I think, was really important in my own thinking, but looking at life and looking at the planet as this expansive set of ecological relationships that are interdependent on each other, I think shifted the work that I wanted to do in the world, the interventions that the book was making. And that came from this realization that the place that I'm from was much more complex and much more internationalist in orientation than I had realized.
You tell these great stories about the immense distance that the eels traveled. We're talking huge amounts of space, and they're carrying with them a kind of history and knowledge because they're adopting to the different environments and they're morphing and they're showing the kind of understanding of being in a particular environment, but taking that history with them as they come down. And this is something Undrowned talks about a lot too, the ways in which they're traveling, almost like archives without being that. And yet, what stops this, and I had a very early example of it many years ago when I was living in Maryland. And they have the canal, and then I was living near a road called Seven Locks, so they have all these locks. And one season, all the fish died because the locks were precisely these sort of interruptions and obstacles to a natural kind of flow of things. And that's what happens with the eels, right? With these dams. And it's tragic and it's horrible the way in which, this human progress, which really isn't, but this attempt to control and enclose natural paths and make it the more quote unquote civilized or purposeful skews things completely off kilter. And that's what makes me laugh, ironically, when we have these schools of sustainability. I mean, that's almost an oxymoron. You can't teach sustainability. Sustainability is, and if you're not willing to listen to it, but rather only dominate it, that's the problem. Another thing I liked a lot about the book is how much self-reflection there is. And you talk about Rebecca Belmore's huge wooden megaphone, and you describe it as, quote, "It asks the speaker to be confronted with their own reflection." So I see a lot of your reflection in this book, but also reflected against and between you and other people, including the person you mentioned, Doug Williams. And what I was really struck by is they're not contiguous moments, but they're moments when you both come up short of your expectations of each other. It's the moment that you describe him being disappointed that you go up north to study with another people. And why don't you stay here? Your work is here. And he wasn't convinced that he was wrong, but he was puzzled. And then almost a complimentary moment when he's dying and you write, "I wasn't able to respond in the way I wanted to," or something like that. Could you talk about how we can learn from exactly that kind of honesty and seeing ourselves, both our success, our good points and our bad points, reflected in our interactions with other people, and how that's almost a sonic reverberation that we should be attuned to rather than shutting it off and clamping down on what we want to be.
So I wrote most of this book after he had passed away, and so there's a fog of grief, but also I think I was missing him and I wanted to be in conversation with him. So the book was a way of still being in conversation with him, although he had passed. In his sort of last few years, he was talking openly to me and his daughters and his family about the end of his life. And I found these conversations very uncomfortable, and I wanted to change the subject. And it wasn't something that I wanted to think about, but I think that he really insisted on it. It was a healthy thing to do, recognize. And I think learning to sit with that uncomfortability and to support him through the final stages of his life, knowing that he could not support me through his loss, was something that I think was new because he was quite a bit older than me. He's almost like a father figure to me. And it felt like this was the first time where it was like the baby bird flying the nest. Like he wasn't going to be here forever. And he needed me to know that and be prepared. And I think that he also needed to know that he had passed what he wanted to pass, what he needed to pass on to me. That kind of more personal narrative kind of quality of the book, I think, comes from that. It comes from Anishinaabe thought is always conveyed through stories. It's conveyed through the personal rather than through that kind of authoritarian academic kind of voice. I think it's shared in a way that people of different ages and different audiences can connect to it, because it's important, I think, within Anishinaabe thought and philosophies that people connect to it. A lot of people connect to it, or it doesn't carry any kind of power. And then I think the other part that made the book what it was is Dion Brand editing it. So she was the editor of the book. And initially, the manuscript that I gave her was quite a bit more academic. She felt that kind of academic discourse was not serving the book and not serving the work that the book was doing. It was being cumbersome and pulling it down. And so she ended up ruthlessly cutting a lot of that, which I was open to. And I'm now very grateful for, because I think that it forced me in a way to do what I think Doug was trying to push me. Like, this is at some point in your life, you can't hide behind footnotes and elders. You have to stand up and say, this is what I think and this is who I am.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because in a way, it gets back to something I said at the beginning of our conversation. You use words from the academy, like theory and internationalism, but they're not latent there and they're not in that space. You bring them into the space of the book, which is very poetic in some ways, and you embody it in the kinds of illustrations that you give. And so you give it an entirely new life, and it's so liberating. And I'll write Deanne a big thank you note, because you know, obviously you trusted her so much. And I was thinking also, as with Doug, he heard his voice reverberating back from you. Mm-hmm. And it must have been such a powerful moment or a series of moments in your long relationship, because he's understanding what his legacy is going to be, how you're reanimating it in your own life, because one doesn't expect to be replicated exactly, because people are people and time is time and circumstances differ. But what you're tapping into and you're gifting us in your book is a kind of continuity that's ours to adapt as we wish. I think that's the other part I like about it. It's a very generous book to the reader. It's not authoritarian by any means, but rather it's a real way to grow capacity. So I wanted to talk more about this idea of sound, because we began with Rebecca Bellamore's Megaphone. And I'd like to turn to your music now. Do you have your book with you, by the way?
I do.
Okay. Because I was going to read your words, but you're much better reading words than I am. It's on page 55, and it's a passage that begins, "If I were to make a map of my territory, it would be a song," which I love. And then the passage would end, "would be a fleeting record of a series of relationships and the cycling of time. It would lead nowhere and everywhere." So could you just read those, I think, four or five sentences? They're so beautiful, and they describe so much of what your music is about.
If I were to make a map of my territory, it would be a song. Song begins inside me. It is a kind of wrestling to articulate the incompleteness of what is inside me, using my poor understanding of my body as instrument and breathing to fuel that instrument. The sound would originate in me and travel. There would be seen and unseen parts. It would be a fleeting record of a series of relationships in the cycling of time. It would lead nowhere and everywhere.
Thank you. I've invited Leanne to share a song with us and then talk about it. But could you talk about the relationship between Theory of Ice and Theory of Water?
Theory of Ice is a musical project. It's an album where I'm thinking through ice and all of its various transformations. I'm mourning the loss of ice and snow in my own territory and in my own life as climate change is encroaching upon us. The first track, Breakup, is about not a breakup, but a lake breaking up in the spring and melting back into water. So I was thinking about lakes. I was thinking with lakes in kind of temperate climates going through these massive upheavals as most of them freeze in the winter and then they melt into a watery liquid again in the summer. So that's one of the tracks. Failure of Melting is about a lake in Gwich'in Territory in the northern part of the Northwest Territories in Canada, where the permafrost is melting. And this lake was cradled by permafrost, which melted, and then the lake fell off a cliff. And I was thinking about that moment where the permafrost gave away, and this lake that was a nest for all of these fish and aquatic species trickled down the mountain and died. OK and Dykes is about the OK Glacier in Iceland that melted and died, and that is now a plaque. I think that record, which came out during the pandemic, and so we didn't get to play it a lot, but it was exploring some of the poetics of water. And I think through writing those songs, writing those lyrics, rehearsing, performing when we could, was a mechanism for me to move from thinking about the poetics of ice and water to this larger project, which became Theory of Water. So I think it was the beginnings of the book in a lot of ways. And I know you can't really write that into a research grant. Like, the first step of my project is I'm going to make this record with my band. And
Oh, why not? I think you should
yeah, I
go
mean,
for
it would be, that's what my process is anyway. And then that sort of, over years of singing those songs and thinking about those ideas, I was able to form the ideas in Theory of Water.
Well, whenever it might be safe for anybody to come to the United States, I would love to have you and your band come perform. It would be amazing. Let's just put it for that time in the future. But
Yes.
I was going to get really fancy by let's share screen this, and then you play the song, and then you. But I think that I'm such a klutz with technology. It
Me
might be
too.
better to go back to you just sending me the file, and I'll
Sure.
stitch it in. But which song would you like to have us listen to?
What was your favorite?
I love Breakup, but I love your discussion of shorelines
Right.
in the book. And so
Yeah.
I was thinking when I was listening to Viscosity, I really got that, and I think that kind of interpenetration, permeability, porousness was really well done. And the way that you take it from other elements, but also embody it yourself, because there's a lot of the human body in
Yeah.
that text too. So
Yeah.
it's really, it flows together so wonderfully.
I know Viscosity is definitely it's my favorite one to play on that record.
Oh.
Yeah, for sure.
powerful moment.
I feel like when we're playing it live, there's a moment where that gets a little bit repetitive at the end, where I can almost lose where I am a little bit. And the band, when we hit it, it's the thing to see, because everybody is in their own orbit, but it all comes together. It started out being a song about the internet and about how damaging our interactions on the internet can be, and about disconnecting and moving to the shore as a way of, I guess now I would say, centering with each other and recovering from that damage. But yeah, it's a fun one to play, for sure.
I suggest to the audience to check out some of the YouTube videos of Leanne's band performing, because the synergy between the musicians is amazing when you're performing, when you're looking at all musicians do this, but in particular, since a lot of your music is very ethereal, is not the best word, but very open in some ways. Mm. And so you're counting on certain clues and cues from each other as to, can we end it now thing, or let's do a few more bars of this because it's really working out well, or I didn't quite. So all those things that we're used to in jazz, for example, you see an improv in this music that is connected to the messaging of the book. Let's loop back maybe as one way to open the last segment with talking about what you call Indigenous internationalism, which is, again, sounds very academic in some ways, but the way that you open it up in the course of the book in many different variations really, really gives us a better sense of it. And you write on 116, "What can I learn as I sit here on the turtle's back and choose not to build a Westphalian state from others engaged in struggle in world building that refuses the same containers that I do?" And again, I was thinking back to Undrowned and the story she tells about the different mammals that just hide. You know, they don't want to be captured physically or in the sort of the epistemology of the people that want to observe them or hunt them or any number of different things. And you talk specifically about this panel you did with William C. Anderson and his book, A Nation on No Map. So what does it mean to refuse the container of a nation state, but also things like being contained in a specific analysis? And I really like the way that you take on Marxism, which you say you're sympathetic to, but it's not the end all. And you say it can't account for what you call, quote, unseen labor systems we don't fully understand. And again, you come up with these short phrases. They open up to so much. I love the phrase unseen labor of systems we don't fully understand. So can you talk more about this as the way it helps us be receptive to the idea of an internationalism that is not internationalism in a kind of socialist communist sense, but in an indigenous sense?
I think one of the things that's embedded in Anishinaabe thought is a tremendous practice of humility. And so if I take that practice of humility and I sit in the forest, I realize that life and living is a profoundly collaborative endeavor. And it's a profoundly diverse endeavor. There's all kinds of different trees around me. There's all kinds of different plants around me. There's different kinds of birds. There's different kinds of mammals. There's all different forms of water. There's worlds underneath me and in the soil that science is just really beginning to understand, thinking about how tree roots and different mosses and algae are communicating underneath the soil. And so I think that Anishinaabe people knew that they didn't understand the full complexity of how the world worked, and that was okay with them. But they had this practice of humility and respect and an idea that they were collaborators with all of the forms of life they were sharing time and space with, and that these different forms of life had large bodies of knowledge and ways of communicating and ways of living that were different, unseen some of the time, and which we didn't understand. And so in order to collaborate with those different forms of life, there's a lot of communication, a lot of different kinds of communication, a lot of fostering this deep And I think back to that story you shared about gift giving. So sometimes that's gift giving, but sometimes that's song, sometimes that's prayer and ceremonies. Sometimes that's looking after the material needs of the living things that you're sharing time and space with. And so I started to look at the forest as not a forest, but as the site of knowledge generation, knowledge mobilization, of diversity, of collaboration. And I think that sort of template or that gift then set me off on a different trajectory in terms of commenting on the present moment and also thinking about how to dream and build beyond this present moment and beyond just critiquing what's happening, but starting to think about how to build the systems to live differently. And using this template of the forest, using the knowledge of these species that are around me through this deep relationality with those species seemed to be an interesting way of doing that. One of the take-home messages in this book, though, is that no, like I don't have all the answers because I need all of the other living things and all of the other peoples of the world and their knowledge in order to fully understand water, for instance. I need to, and I think about how my ancestors lived and how they were skilled. They were very skilled in a lot of ways that I am not skilled, but one of the ways that they were skilled is just in relationships, in navigating conflict, in renewal, in figuring out how to work with their family, with their extended family, with their community in some really difficult, quite violent times. And I think that skill set of figuring out how to take care of each other when we don't agree, when we're in conflict, recognizing that we actually don't have to rebuild the world. There is a natural world that's already there. We just have to figure out how to fit into it in a way that doesn't ruin it and that doesn't ruin the other living things that we're on the planet with.
I'd like to end perhaps with one of the most horrific, terrible, moving passages. When you're talking about that photograph that you come upon of these indigenous children who are obviously in a boarding school and they're sitting on the edge of a lake, again, or a river, I'm not sure, and they're looking at a white man in a canoe. I'd like to have you talk about that. You stitch that together with the children in Gaza. And a lot of what you talk about in terms of indigenous internationalism is both world-making but life-making. And this is where I want to be open, I want to be patient, I want to see the natural world. But as you said a few minutes ago, it's so hard to be patient when so much stuff is going down so quickly and so massively. So could you talk about that photograph, and then maybe we could talk about Gaza?
Yeah, so that's a photograph that Rebecca Belmore has used in one of her installations where she takes that photograph and she takes a kind of a denim material and installs into a gallery what looks like waves. So the photograph is of this group of boys, I would say like young, 6 or 7. They're on the side of what we think is a river. There's a man fishing. There's the looks on their faces is one of, I guess I project, but it's one of like, they just, I think, are very happy to not be in a school situation, but also they would love to be like frolicking around in the water and laughing and playing. And they're all in these identical, almost looks like prison uniforms with buzzed haircuts instead of long braids, which was all very common in the residential school era. And so I think that the photograph hits you when you see it. And in Rebecca's installation, you also get a sense of the horror and the violence of separating indigenous children from the land, from their language, from their culture, from their families, and from being conduits in learning these kinds of systems that sustained our peoples and taught us how to weave ourselves into this network of life. For me, it's a piece that kind of moves beyond the kind of individual abuse that happened so much in residential schools and makes me think about the larger reasons why the government took these children and tried to assimilate them into Canadian society, because being in love with the land and being in love with culture and living in this way was a threat to the state. And once you had people off the land, then it was much easier to develop natural resources. And so, thinking of that photograph, moving beyond the way that it lands emotionally on you and starting to connect it to systems of capitalism, systems of colonialism, systems of settler colonialism, I think immediately for me makes me think of children in Gaza, makes me think of Palestinian children in the West Bank and Hebron, and what they're forced to live through right now because of settler colonialism. And I think the parallels are very palatable, I think, for me.
Yeah, and these operations of death making as opposed to life making are, as you point out in the book, on all these different scales, all these different scales and different terrains, and that you pull on one part and the rest collapses. But capitalism doesn't care. They will extract as much as they can out of this part before it collapses and then something else. But I think the book really helps us understand the planet and our place in it and the ways in which the planet is guiding us if we can just step back and listen to it and not be didactic or authoritarian, but seeing what fits best as a way of life-giving at any particular moment and sharing that. So thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been a real honor and a privilege, and the book is just amazing, and I hope everybody gets a chance to look at it and listen to the album too, because I think they work really well together, actually, even though they're separated in time by some degree. So thank you so much, Leanne.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a wonderful conversation, and I really appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Have a good day,
Bye-bye.
David.
Same to
Bye
you. Bye-bye.